Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to Washington Today for Monday, April 24th, 2023. I'm Gary Starkoff. Thanks a lot for joining us today. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has announced a ceasefire between warring military factions in Sudan. The announcement comes after the successful evacuation of U.S. diplomatic staff in Khartoum over the weekend. On Capitol Hill, the House plans to vote this week on the Republicans' bill that links a debt ceiling increase with spending cuts. But President Biden isn't budging on his position to not tie the two together. And the three Tennessee state lawmakers who faced expulsion after participating in gun control protests at the state capitol after last month's shooting in Nashville visited the White House today. The three lawmakers will be asking President Biden to declare a public health emergency on gun violence. We begin here in Washington at the State Department, and here's the official statement from Secretary Blinken. Following intense negotiation over the past 48 hours, the Sudanese Armed Forces, or SAF, and the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, have agreed to implement a nationwide ceasefire starting at midnight on April 24th to last for 72 hours. During this period, the United States urges the SAF and RSF to immediately and fully uphold the ceasefire. To support a durable end to the fighting, the United States will coordinate with regional and international partners and Sudanese civilian stakeholders to assist in the creation of a committee to oversee the negotiation, conclusion, and implementation of a permanent cessation of hostilities and humanitarian arrangements in Sudan. We will continue to work with the Sudanese parties and our partners toward the shared goal of a return to civilian government in Sudan. That's the official statement from Secretary of State Antony Blinken on a ceasefire in Sudan, where warring military factions have been going at it for several days. Now, earlier today, the secretary talked about the evacuation of U.S. diplomatic staff in Khartoum.
On Saturday, I directed the temporary suspension of operations at Embassy Khartoum, and we conducted a successful operation to safely evacuate all U.S. Embassy personnel and their dependents. I want to reiterate my appreciation for the leadership of Ambassador John Godfrey and the entire embassy team who managed the consolidation of our people and the necessary preparations for the evacuation under a very fluid security situation, even as they were tirelessly working to broker an Eid ceasefire. I could not be prouder of our team, most of whom are now en route back to the United States. I especially want to express my gratitude to Secretary of Defense Austin, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs Milley, and the men and women of the U.S. military who executed the evacuation operation with their usual extraordinary precision and skill. They once again demonstrated that they are the finest in the world. A decision to suspend operations at the embassy, remove our personnel from their assigned posts, is among the most difficult that any secretary has to make. But my first priority is the safety of our people, and I determined that the deteriorating security conditions in Khartoum posed an unacceptable risk to keeping our team there at this time. I want to be clear that even as we have temporarily suspended operations on the ground in Khartoum, our diplomatic and consular work in Sudan continues. Indeed, in just the last 36 hours since the embassy evacuation operation was completed, we've continued to be in close communication with U.S. citizens and individuals affiliated with the U.S. government to provide assistance and facilitate available departure routes for those seeking to move to safety via land, air, and sea. This includes Americans who are traveling overland in the U.N. convoy from Khartoum to Port Sudan. We also continue to coordinate with allies and partners who are conducting their own operations and to leverage those efforts to include Americans. We're taking further steps to support Americans and are exploring options to return a diplomatic and consular presence to Sudan as soon as possible. We've also continued to engage directly with General Burhan and General Hemedti to press them to extend and expand the Eid ceasefire to a sustainable cessation of hostilities that prevents further violence, and upholds humanitarian obligations. The Sudanese people are not giving up on their aspirations for a secure, free, and democratic future. Neither will we. The United States will work with all parties, in coordination with regional and international partners, to bring an end to the fighting and a return to the transition to a civilian government. Kenya, under President Ruto, has been a strong partner in this effort. And indeed, Kenya is a security leader throughout the region. That's evident not only in its commitment to resolving the current crisis in Sudan, but also in its support for United Nations and African Union peacekeeping efforts and the counterterrorism mission in Somalia, in its partnership to reach the November 2nd cessation of hostilities agreement in Ethiopia, and in its stewardship of the Nairobi process to advance peace and stability in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Now, the embassy closure there comes after a week of heavy fighting between rival military factions, which has left hundreds dead and thousands wounded. Over the weekend, officials from Canada, the UK, Germany, India, South Korea, Japan, and several other nations also worked to get their diplomats out of the country. According to the State Department, there are about 16,000 Americans living in Sudan. Here's more from Secretary Blinken.
First, in terms of American citizens in Sudan, as you know, in any country around the world, whether it's Sudan or anywhere else, we never know with any precision how many Americans may be there at any given time because Americans are not required to register with the embassy, with the government, either when they go, when they reside, or when they leave. So we don't have a good fix on the number of Americans who are there at any given time, including now. We do know, of course, the number of Americans who have registered with us and with whom we're in very active touch, communication. And of those, I would say some dozens have expressed an interest in leaving. And as I mentioned just a few moments ago, even with the withdrawal of our embassy personnel from Sudan, our efforts to provide services to American citizens who are there, consular services, other services, advice continues, and we're in regular communication with American citizens. We are looking to see how we can help them ensure their own safety. We have been working with allies and with partners to do as much as we can to enable them to find their way out if that's what they choose to do. Now, keep in mind as well that the overwhelming majority of American citizens in Sudan are dual nationals who have made their lives there, have been living there for years, for decades, for generations, and many want to continue to do that. But for those who are seeking to leave, we'll continue to engage directly with them to see what we can do to help them, and as I said, with allies and partners as well. Help facilitate their departure, and this is going to be an ongoing process.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken speaking to the media before he announced a ceasefire between the two military factions in Sudan. You can see all of that event at cspan.org. On Capitol Hill, Congress returns to work tomorrow. The House plans to vote later this week on Speaker Kevin McCarthy's bill that will increase the federal debt limit and slash government spending. At today's White House briefing, Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre talked about that bill, and she also reiterated the president's stance on the debt ceiling talks.
Look, we've been very clear. We're not going to negotiate over avoiding default. We've been very clear about that. The administration is going to have a conversation with leaders over the budget, over the spending cuts. We've been very clear about that. We have said that from the beginning of this process that, look, we'll have that conversation. But when it comes to default, when it comes to their constitutional duty, that is something that they can do today. They can actually deal with something that would be devastating if they didn't take action, right? Now, when it comes to what we have seen them put forward, 22% cut on education, on veterans, on Meals on Wheels, on food safety, on law enforcement. All of those things are devastating to workers, seniors, to our children, to working families. And clearly they showed us what their value were. But what they have done is they have put those two things together, debt ceiling and spending cuts. And we have always been very clear, Zeke. We have been very, very clear. We are not going to negotiate when it comes to the full faith and credit of this nation. And they are holding that hostage currently. They are holding the economy hostage. And so, look, they have to, we're not negotiating over that, and they have to avoid default. It's very clear. They need to make sure that we're not put in a situation where our economy could be put at risk.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen has said that without a debt ceiling hike, the government could default on its bills sometime between June and September. That could set off serious global economic consequences. Here's more from the White House.
Thanks, Karine. I want to follow up on what Zeke asked there. Senator Klobuchar on CNN yesterday said that President Biden should sit down and negotiate with the Speaker on the budget, but also made clear that the spending cuts and should not be tied to the debt ceiling. And so would President Biden sit down with McCarthy to debate, to negotiate their different budget proposals? Or what is the position?
So I want to be very clear here. The House Republicans' position is, unless the president and the Senate agree to their entire agenda, that they're going to default and crash the economy. And that is dangerous. That is something that we're going to continue to call out, and it is unreasonable to do. We have been very clear. There will not be any negotiation around the debt ceiling. Right? This is something that is their constitutional duty to do. They've done it three times. You've heard me say it over and over again. They did it three times in the last administration, and they should do it now. And look, every Republican that votes for this bill that Speaker McCarthy and MAGA Republicans have put forth, they're voting for cutting costs on veterans. They're voting for cutting costs on education. I just laid out at the top of the briefing what that would mean. 60,000. I mentioned 60,000 teachers. I mentioned how many kids it would affect, and so that's what they would be voting for, against those things that American families need. And we're talking about programs that they need to meet ends meet. And so we've been very, very clear. It is unreasonable to put forth what they did last week. It is cruel. That piece of legislation is cruel. And so they need to really make sure that we don't go into default. And that's what they're asking to do. They're asking to hold our economy hostage and go into default. And that's something that we're going to continue to call out.
Now, last week, you didn't seem to rule out the possibility, though, of President Biden sitting down with McCarthy at some point. Is that something you're open to?
So look, again, House Republicans must avoid default, been very clear. And that is within their power to do at any moment. That is within their power to do at any moment. And so that's what we're expecting them to see.
White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre. In spite of the White House position, New York Republican Anthony Desposito says he thinks Speaker McCarthy's bill is the right approach.
I've had conversations with a lot of my New York colleagues over the weekend. We've spoken with leadership, and we're looking forward to the Limit, Save, Grow Act of 2023. It has the potential to put $4.5 trillion back to taxpayers and back into our economy. We've seen over the last few months, as our speaker has said, that the president has just ignored the opportunity to sit down, negotiate, and have a conversation with our leadership. And quite frankly, they've done a great job as, trying to cause havoc and create fear about defaulting. But the only ones that have been working to find a solution are the Republicans.
That's New York Republican Anthony Desposito on Fox News on Monday. And USNews.com writing today that the House Republican bill is, quote, dead on arrival in the Senate, but its approval in the lower chamber is key for Speaker McCarthy, who has railed against President Biden's unwillingness to negotiate spending cuts tied to a debt ceiling increase while ramping up calls for another meeting in recent days. And with more on what's in the Republican bill and the stakes for Speaker McCarthy, we talked to Politico congressional reporter Daniela Diaz.
We are expecting probably the busiest week in Washington. This week, McCarthy's biggest hurdle since he became Speaker in January, which is him trying to pass this huge package through the House that would address the debt limit for the next year. Lots of things that are part of these negotiations. It would cap spending limits to 2022 fiscal spending year. It would either raise the debt limit for a year or until it reached $32.9 trillion by the role. But alongside, or not even regarding that, he has to get all of his Republicans behind this. He only has 4 votes he can lose in the House with Republicans, and that's if no Democrat supports this, which we're not expecting any Democrats to support this as of now. And what we're watching this week is his negotiations with his own conference to see if he can get it over the finish line.
As far as were they working through the weekend in order to achieve that, to get those votes, to secure that leading up to the vote?
Absolutely. We know that they were meeting on certain things. They want to address the Inflation Reduction Act, take out some of those tax credits that were given to people. They also are addressing work requirements for anyone that qualifies for Medicaid or any other sort of benefits. These are all things that they want to address in this package. But Pedro, we can't talk about this without really knowing or talking about the fact that this won't pass the Senate, right? Because the Senate is a Democratic-led Senate, 51-49 split. So regardless of whatever they pass in the House, McCarthy is going to have to negotiate with Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer and President Joe Biden. But the goal here is to get it over.
Let me play a little bit from Speaker McCarthy yesterday. Perfect. Still upbeat about what he expects going on this week. I'll play a little bit of what he had to say. We'll talk about it on the other side.
But I cannot imagine someone in our conference that would want to go along with Biden's reckless spending. This is responsible. This is something that we have sat down for months that everybody's had input in. It's not where everybody gets 100% of what they want. But when we send this to the Senate, we're showing that, yes, we're able to raise the debt ceiling into the next year. But what we're doing is we're being responsible fiscally and bringing our house back in order. It doesn't solve all of our problems, but it gets us on the right path. And this gets us to the negotiating table, just as government and America expects us to do.
So do you feel that you can hold a vote this upcoming week? What are your plans?
We will hold a vote this week and we will pass it and we will send it to the Senate.
So there's the confidence factor from Speaker McCarthy. In reality, then, who are the ones to watch in the House side that still might be holdouts here?
The House Freedom Caucus. These are the group of really conservative members, the Thomas Massies, the Matt Gaetz, now Marjorie Taylor Greene being a very strong McCarthy ally, but that is the group I'm talking about. They want stronger work requirements. They want stricter enforcement for benefits in the United States. They want that all included in this language for this proposal. So we're going to watch whether he can reach those negotiations with those members. So those are the ones to watch.
Have they telegraphed anything of where they are right now?
You know, there's a small group that aren't sure where they are. You know, I'm speaking specifically about Tim Burchett, who has a member that is quite a character, a really interesting member. He has said he doesn't know where he is. Now, another member that we should watch is Tony Gonzalez. He is holding up a separate set of bills on the border and border security for the debt limit proposal. He said that if this other set of bills to address border security does not go through or does not include a legal immigration provisions that he wants included in this legislation that is currently being taken up by the House Judiciary Committee, then he won't vote for the debt proposal. And that is something that we're watching. You know, we spotted him meeting with McCarthy in his office last week. So McCarthy is trying to get these votes. But again, can't emphasize enough, he only has a 4-vote margin here. And that's if no Democrats pass this. And then again, it could pass the House, but they still have to continue negotiating.
No Senate, or at least on the Senate side, you saw a little bit of support from Joe Manchin. But as far as Democrats are concerned on the Senate side, no support for what we're seeing is coming out of the House.
And Joe Manchin, as the sole Democrat that is praising McCarthy for this proposal and calling on President Joe Biden to negotiate with him, he's not going to get this over the finish line alone. They're going to need 60 votes in the Senate to pass this, Pedro, and right now they don't have that. And Senate Majority Leader McCarthy is saying that he, or I'm sorry, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is saying that he wants to negotiate, but he's leaving it to President Joe Biden to do that. And so far, they've only had that one meeting, if you remember, in January, McCarthy and Biden. McCarthy's been calling Biden to come to the table. Biden is waiting. We'll see what happens.
To what degree is there a sense of nervousness, either from Republicans or Democrats, about something being done on this issue?
Everyone's worried. They know that they can't let the nation's debt go into default. Like they need to pay back their bills. or pay their bills, not let that happen. So everyone's nervous that I've been talking to all the lawmakers on Capitol Hill. They all want to do something, but Democrats don't want other things in that proposal to raise the debt limit. They don't think it needs to have additional provisions. Republicans disagree.
Politico congressional reporter Daniela Diaz on today's Washington Journal. You can see more at cspan.org/Washington Journal and on the C-SPAN Now video app. The Senate is scheduled to return tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern as well. Later in the week, they will begin work on a bill requiring the VA to conduct research on the health effects of medicinal cannabis for veterans with chronic pain and PTSD. And the Senate may also vote on Majority Leader Schumer's resolution that denounces former President Trump's call to defund the FBI and the Justice Department. And coming up on Capitol Hill on Thursday, South Korea's president will address a joint meeting of Congress in the House chamber. You're listening to Washington Today. Welcome back to Washington Today. According to multiple news reports, Susan Rice, a senior advisor to President Biden, is stepping down from her post next month. As head of the White House Domestic Policy Council, Susan Rice has overseen the president's agenda on issues like immigration, health care, and gun safety. White House Chief of Staff Jeffrey Zients called her work critical to the president's agenda and said that she has taken the Domestic Policy Council to, quote, new heights. Speculation is also rising that President Biden could announce his 2024 re-election campaign as early as tomorrow. If it happens, it would come exactly 4 years after he announced his entry into the 2020 race. The president is scheduled to speak at a labor union conference here in Washington tomorrow. That's a similar setting as his first campaign event in 2019 when he spoke at a union hall in Pittsburgh. Director of National Intelligence Avril Haines is sounding the alarm on the ability of governments to control their citizens through technology, and that includes here in the U.S. We'll hear what she had to say coming up. The three Tennessee state lawmakers who faced expulsion after participating in gun control protests at the Tennessee State Capitol following last month's school shooting in Nashville visited the White House today. Known as the Tennessee Three, State Representatives Justin Pearson, Justin Jones, and Gloria Johnson, all Democrats, said they were planning to ask the president to declare a public health emergency on gun violence. Representatives Pearson and Jones were expelled from the state legislature after their protest, while Representative Johnson was not. The two were later reinstated by local officials. And here's President Biden talking in the Oval Office about their visit.
Well, it's an honor to have you all three here. It really is. And I know you got a chance. The Vice President went down to see you. I'm sorry I couldn't be with her at the time. But, you know, you're standing up for our kids. You're standing up for our communities, safer communities, and democratic values. That's what it's all about. And you're all three of you speak so well about why you're doing what you did and why you continue to do it. And look, what the Republican legislature did was shocking, it was undemocratic, and it was without any precedent. But you turned it around very quickly. And we passed the most significant gun laws that have passed in 30 years, but there's more to do. What happened was that we did, we met background checks and, you know, legislation, so-called red flag laws. But I signed the most extensive gun legislation in 30 years. But what I'm more proud of is when I was a senator, I was able to lead the fight with Dianne Feinstein to block the sale of assault weapons and the number of cartridges that could be in a magazine. And I think we still have to do that. But on so many issues, you've been out front and you understand exactly what it's like. It's just tragic to see what's happening in your state in particular, in your city, but also across the country. And, you know, nothing's guaranteed about democracy. Every generation has to fight for it. And you all are doing just that. And so, you know, we have a lot to discuss. And with that, I know they're going to be really excited, but I'm going to ask the press to leave. Thank you.
Mr. President, why do you want to go for this?
So I get to answer
Representatives Pearson, Jones, and Johnson's visit prompted a response from one of Tennessee's senators. Here's Republican Bill Hagerty.
You know, I understand that this White House is focused entirely on politics. I'm certainly focused on the Covenant Six, those who lost their lives. We're doing what we can to put in place legislation to harden schools, to protect these children, to protect the most vulnerable. And political stunts really are secondary in mind, I think, to everyone, certainly in Tennessee, that cares about the situation at Covenant School.
Yeah, is that what you call it, a stunt? Do you think it was a stunt?
Well, certainly it was a stunt that took place on the floor of the Tennessee Senate. The bullhorns, all of the racket making, they knew what the rules were. But again, this has turned into something that I think the White House can make some political gains on. At least that's their calculation. I wish they would instead focus on the victims of this horrendous murder.
Yeah, what is your reaction to that, that they have not been, the families of the shooting victims have not been invited to the White House, yet they're inviting these three? Here are the faces. You have 3 9-year-olds that were killed and 3 adults.
Everyone in Tennessee's hearts are broken about this. We are extraordinarily focused on the families, those whose lives were lost. And Senator Blackburn and I have put in place legislation to harden schools at the federal level. The state legislature has put in place more resources for schools to protect them. And I think the Tennessee legislature is looking at a special session to come back together right now to see what more that can be done.
Right. But Senator, why do you think they haven't invited the families of those who lost their lives?
Again, we've got an administration in the White House that's far more focused on press releases, spin, and politics than they are on substance and reality. It's not just what's happening here domestically, it's what's happening around the world.
Tennessee Republican Senator Bill Hagerty on Fox News on Monday morning. Finally, the ability of governments to control their citizens through technology was the topic of an event here in Washington today. It's known as digital authoritarianism, and it works not only through censorship and spreading disinformation, but also through collecting data on people while they're online and using social media. Now, Russia and China might be the best-known governments that use digital authoritarian tactics, but the practice is spreading throughout the world, including here in the U.S. With more, here's Director of National Intelligence Avril Haines.
I think it's important for our voice to be heard on this, too, to make it clear that it's not just the, you know, foreign secretary, in a sense, that cares about this issue, but it's also the security services that care about this issue. And I do care deeply about this issue. I, first of all, really believe it is a national security threat. And if you look at our annual threat assessment, we, for the first time, have a whole section on digital trends of authoritarianism. So that is something that we're highlighting. But it's also, it's a place where I think we uniquely can bring analysis, insight into essentially how it's happening and what the challenges are. So I believe that that's something we should be doing more generally. But I also want to make clear that there's a real distinction between intelligence services in a democratic society and one in an authoritarian. And there are, you know, structures around that. And that doesn't mean that, in other words, we should be having the conversation where people have concerns that it is creeping into our own system, and that's something that needs to be on the table as well, at the same time that we're talking about how does this happen and how can we all move forward in a way that's actually going to counter what we're seeing and that we have a concern with. If that makes sense.
The timing of your kind of alarm cry, is that driven more by geopolitics or more by, as somebody sitting over the intel community, seeing around corners and saying, gosh, there's something that's about to hit us like a wave, and we're not there yet. We need to be ready for this or be more thoughtful about how we're encountering it.
Yeah, so I'd say it's a combination, not surprisingly, but here's what I think is really intensifying in this moment that makes it so critical. If you look at a combination of the pandemic, right, which basically both put an emphasis on tracking data of individuals who had contact with, et cetera, right? Like all of us doing, all of us engaging more through digital means, right? It sort of pushed society into that space where there was increasing amounts of data that was available publicly about all of us in many respects, with the extraordinary trend of digital technologies, of emerging technologies, right? Where, you know, we talk about the trajectory for the Internet of Things, which is obviously, you know, enormous, as I've indicated in my remarks. But that combined with a whole series of other types of technologies like spyware and so on that are becoming commercially available, that are cheap, that are easy to get, so that you can really engage in digital authoritarianism at scale, right? And then you look at how it's not just being engaged in at scale by sort of the classic authoritarian countries that you're used to looking at it, but what you're recognizing is that there's a kind of a export of these structures. And really, you know, from my perspective, in addition to obviously then wanting to sound the alarm, put forward what the threat is and to try to analyze it, I think part of what I'm hoping to do is to set up for a better conversation about how we can create greater resilience for it.
That's Director of National Intelligence Avril Haines talking to Dan Baer, who's Senior Vice President for Policy Research and Director of the Europe Program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. You can see that entire event at cspan.org. That's also where you can find this program as a podcast, cspan.org/podcasts. You can also get it wherever you get your favorite podcasts. And if you'd like more on the stories that are shaping Washington, subscribe to our evening newsletter, word for word. Just go to cspan.org/connect to subscribe. I'm Gary Sterkoff. Thanks a lot for listening today to Washington Today.